So, on to a new section, the final block of the course. In the first part of the course, beginning of the semester, we studied how the American economy works. And if you want to distill the lesson, the message from that first part of the course, the central idea was that the kind of capitalist market economy we have often works quite well, producing in an efficient way with innovation and new kinds of products, but it also generates certain very important inefficiencies and creates serious problems which the market itself can't solve. In one way or another, these problems can only be countered by what I called an affirmative state: government actions to correct the pathologies of markets. And there really is no other solution. There are various ways that governments can act. It's not that there's only one type of policy, but you really cannot deal with the sorts of negative externalities and inconsistencies in the way markets work. You just can't deal with it by just relying on the market itself. You need some other kind of machinery in place, social technologies, if you will, and that's what the affirmative state does. The second part of the course, which we just finished, we dealt with the value of fairness and the problems of inequality. Especially, I think we focused on economic inequality, the problems of poverty and wealth inequality, but also in the last half of the previous section, we dealt with race and gender inequality. And the central theme of that part of the course, which we just finished, is that the extremely high levels of economic inequality and poverty in the United States pose very serious challenges to the principles of fairness. And the enduring problems of race, racial inequality, and gender inequality also pose serious problems of fairness. And again, I think if you want a simple kind of bottom line conclusion, these problems of fairness will not be spontaneously remedied through completely decentralized, uncoordinated efforts. And above all, they're not going to be remedied by markets. If you value fairness, if you think this is an ideal which we would like our social institutions to embody, if this is a value that you care about, it requires some kind of collective response. And the institution we have for a coherent collective response is, again, an affirmative state. And so this brings us to the problem of democracy. Because after all, states don't have to be democratic. There are, throughout history, in fact, the vast majority of political institutions that have been organized to solve problems collectively. Those institutions have been deeply undemocratic. The problem of democracy, then, is how can we create political institutions capable of solving problems which are also responsive to the will of the people? That's the problem of democracy, and that will be the subject of the last part of the course. So, first, how to think about democracy. Let's first think about this as an ideal and try to give more precision to the general notion. So the simple definition is rule by the people. In the American context, we have this nice triplet that Abraham Lincoln announced in his famous Gettysburg Address: government of the people, by the people, and for the people. For the people means a government that serves the broad interests of ordinary citizens, not a government that is primarily oriented to serving the interests of elites. By the people means that it's the people that choose the government. They're selected by ordinary people. Of the people means that the people that are selected should also come from the politicians that are selected should also be ordinary citizens. They shouldn't just be aristocrats chosen by the people to run the government for them. They should be ordinary citizens chosen by the people to run government on their behalf. That's the trickiest in the way. That's the part of the equation that's never been really seriously addressed. How can you have a system of selecting officials in which the officials themselves are ordinary folks, rather than that you're selecting some kind of special class from amongst a special class of people, and they're the ones who will govern? We've done better at by the people than of the people. We'll discuss some possibilities for how you might have a democracy of the people and not just by the people. We'll discuss that later. Well, that's the simple definition. It's not so simple even that when you think about it. Rule by the people. That's a pretty extraordinary idea, rule by the people. It's a pretty wild sort of notion when you really think about it. And it's very rare. You know, there was a time in human history before there were states, when we lived in small hunter and gathering bands. We don't know exactly how coordination, how those societies were ruled, but they were probably ruled in a pretty egalitarian, consensus-oriented way. At least that's the conventional thinking about them. But from the beginning, once states were created, that is, institutions that imposed rules on the lives of people from above, those states were profoundly undemocratic. It was never really considered possible that ordinary people could actually govern themselves. Even in Athens, which is the fabled origin of Western democracy, it was really only free males that were citizens. Women couldn't serve politically, and slaves couldn't serve politically. So to call Athenian democracy democracy, you have to really put democracy in quotes. It's sort of proto-democracy for the privileged elite, as opposed to what we would today consider democracy. Democracy is a very wild and radical idea. If you take it seriously, as opposed to think of it as just a kind of symbolic window dressing, if you really take it seriously that we should live in a world where ordinary people rule, that they determine the rules under which they will live, that's a very radical idea, and a very difficult ideal to put into practice. Most Americans, I think, believe that we live in a pretty democratic society. Maybe fewer believe that today than sometimes in the past, but mostly we think of the United States as one of the leading democracies. Although it turns out that on most indicators of how democratic a democracy we live in, we rank pretty far down the list of those countries that are broadly considered democratic. But still, what do we mean by it? What's the real value? Well, the simple definition is rule by the people. A more complicated idea requires us to really think about what it means for people to be ruling. What's the value that underlies that? Why do we care? Why does it matter? Why do we think it's a good idea, even if difficult to realize in practice, for people to govern themselves? What's the abstract value? I think the abstract value that's at the core of democracy can be called self-determination. Self-determination. People should be able, to the greatest extent possible, determine the course of their own lives. Should be self-determining rather than having others determine the course of your life. All people should have broadly equal access to the necessary means to participate in decisions that affect their lives. That's what self-determination means. You should be able to participate meaningfully in decisions over things which affect your life. This includes both the freedom of individuals to make choices that affect their own lives as separate persons, and their capacity to participate in collective decisions which affect their lives as members of a broader community. So once you realize that the core value that underlies the ideal of democracy is self-determination, you immediately confront this interesting tension between two contexts in which self-determination matters for people. One is a context where you're simply making choices about yourself as a separate person, choices that don't really have much effect on anybody else. And another context is where there are decisions to be made that affect you, but they affect everybody else as well, or many other people as well. Self-determination means individual freedom without interference to make choices about your own life when those choices don't affect other people. And it means a capacity to participate in collective decisions which affect your life as a member of a community. So there's a double aspect to self-determination. So one way of thinking about it is that self-determination is the underlying value that underwrites the concept of freedom, individual freedom. That's your capacity to make choices over your own life as a separate person without asking permission. You don't have to clear it with anybody. If you are making a decision, a choice about your own life, you just make that choice. You evaluate it on the basis of your own preferences and needs and capacities, but you don't have to ask permission. That's the capacity to make choices over your own life as a separate person. But freedom also involves the capacity to participate in the effective control over collective choices that affects one's life as a member of a wider society. That's what we call democracy. What this means, that freedom and democracy, this couplet, freedom and democracy, individual freedom and collective democracy, actually share a common value. They share a common underlying value. That doesn't mean there aren't tensions between freedom and democracy, but they are tensions within the realization of a single value. And that is really the central problem. Because there's a pervasive interdependency between your life as a separate person and your life as a member of a community of people, of interacting community, because there is a deep and pervasive interdependency of these two aspects of self-determination, you have this problem of how to draw a line between decisions that are left up to an individual and decisions that are made collectively. This can be thought of as the boundary between private and public. The boundary between the private and the public. And here's the kicker on here. There is no natural solution to this problem. There's no kind of given by nature line of demarcation between the realm of choices which are strictly private, that is, that affect you and only you, and therefore you can make them without consulting anybody else because they don't affect anybody else, and decisions which affect lots of other people and therefore they should be consulted in making those decisions. There is no natural boundary between these. This is a boundary that has to be drawn through some kind of political process. So this leads to a further refinement of the definition of democracy. In a democracy, all decisions which affect our common fate and common interests should reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than of powerful elites. So there's two key elements here. Decisions that affect our common fate and common interests. Common fate and common interests. What do we mean by common fate and common interests? Well, again, there is no simple answer to that question. This is a point of clarification that comes a little bit earlier that I skipped over. This has to do with the difficulty of drawing this boundary between the public and the private, right? Between the decisions that affect just yourself and decisions that affect others. We've explored some of these in other parts of the course already. I buy expensive schooling for my children, and this hurts the competitive positions of poor children, right? So we consider it a private decision how much to spend on the education of your children. That's not a decision we leave up to the state. That's not a decision that we make collectively. We leave that up to individuals. Nevertheless, that does significantly affect the prospects of other people. Your choice to give advantages to your children affects the prospects of others because of the competitive nature of access to higher education and other rewards. That reflects interdependency. Should we draw the line of between private and public that way? Should we allow people to spend as much as they want to give advantages to their children? Maybe we should. Maybe that, on balance, is the right trade-off between allowing people to live their lives the way they want, irrespective of the consequences for other people. Right? So that's deciding that even though it has big effects on other people, we don't want those other people to be involved in the decision. We're drawing the line of demarcation in a particular way. I buy a SUV to make driving safer for my family. But this makes it less safe for other people. You know, and there's a kind of arms race in automobile armor, right? So that if everybody has SUVs, then the advantage of being in an SUV declines. If you're the only person who has an SUV and everybody else are driving small cars, then you're much safer on the road than you would otherwise be. As a bicyclist, I would prefer a world where there were no SUVs because, fortunately, I was hit by a very small, low-slung car last November. I don't know what the consequences would have been, but if I had been hit by a large, you know, heavy pickup truck at the same speed that I was hit by this smaller car, I suspect the damage would have been much greater. Well, should the decision whether you buy an SUV be left up to individuals, or should we actually have regulation on how dangerous cars should be for other people? Again, we've drawn that line politically. We've decided, no, we'll just let people buy whatever cars they want. They have to be licensed. They have to know how to drive. So we do put restrictions on who can drive a car and what their conditions of driving have to be. They have to know how to do it and they have to follow the rules of the road, but we don't put restrictions on what kind of cars people can buy. Or another example of the difficult matter of how do you draw the lines of demarcation between the public and the private? How do you decide what should be in the space of democracy? I own a factory and I decide to move it to Mexico to make a higher profit. But this destroys jobs at home and causes devastation for the values of homes in the city from which I have moved my factory. Is that a private decision? Is that a kind of decision that we should just leave up to people based on their own self-interest? Or is that really an example of a decision that affects so many other people so deeply that it's a decision that should be made under democratic conditions, not just private decisions? That should be a public decision, not just a private decision. Again, it's a difficult question. I'm not saying by raising this issue that the line of demarcation between what should be left up to individual choice under the heading of freedom and what should be packaged with democracy under the heading of collective decisions that affect our lives as members of a community. I'm not saying that that's an easy line of demarcation to draw. What I am saying is that it's very consequential how you draw it. And that there is no natural way of drawing it. That is, it's not something that can be given just by looking at nature. It's something that has to be decided by thinking through the implications of alternatives. And in the United States, we allow a huge range of really important decisions to be made by private individuals in which they're given permission to only ask the question, how is this good for me? Not what are its implications for others. And that's a decision about the boundary line between the context of individual freedom and the context of democracy. We draw that line in such a way as to create a relatively restricted domain for democratic governance. Okay, back to the definition then of democracy. In a democracy, all decisions which affect our common fate and common interests should reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than of powerful elites. So the first part of that is decisions that affect our common fate and common interests. Common fate and common interests. We then have to decide what are we going to put into that common fate and common interests. And what are we going to exclude from it? That's the issue of drawing the boundary between individual freedom and collective choice. And the second part is that the decisions which do affect our common fate and common interest should reflect the collective will of equal citizens. That's the basis on which we should make those decisions, rather than of powerful elites. What do we mean by collective will? That's a pretty tricky idea, collective will. We know what an individual will is, right? We all have minds, we all make choices, we know what it is to think through a problem and to decide what to do as individuals, personally. So the idea of an individual will, although philosophically even that gets a little tricky, at least it has a strong intuitive idea. We all experience in our own lives having an individual will. Well, what do we mean by a collective will? That's not so simple a concept, a collective will. A very strong view is that a collective will means that there has to be a broad, deep consensus in the society. That's a collective will. That's kind of like the collective analog to an individual will. So when you decide what you want to do, in a sense, you have an internal consensus, right? So you have a bunch of different things you'd like to do. You're pulled in one way or another. Well, you come to an agreement with yourself, and you fully agree with yourself, right? You have a kind of internal consensus over what to do. Well, a strong view of a collective will is just the analog to the individual will. You have collective will when everybody agrees. Well, that's pretty implausible. There's virtually no issue of any consequence in which everybody would agree. Usually there are strong disagreements within any large collectivity. Disagreements for all sorts of reasons. Disagreements because people have different values, different information, different theories, different religions. There's all sorts of reasons why we have disagreements. So something short of consensus is required in order to put any practical meaning to the notion that in a democracy it's the collective will of equal citizens rather than powerful elites that determine what choices get made. I think the best we can do in general is to have wide public discussion and public deliberation seeking as broad a consensus as possible that settles on some form of majority rule. And that's indeed how democracies have functioned in one way or another at their best. It's the process by which a final decision gets made through public deliberation and public discussion that generates confidence that you're doing as well as you can in producing a good enough consensus through some kind of majority rule principle. All right, well, if that's our broad understanding of democracy, the kind of definition that we'll use as our the basis for our exploration of democracy in the United States, democracy is a form of government in which all decisions which affect our common fate and common interests should reflect the collective will, that is, the collective deliberation and participation of equal citizens rather than of powerful elites. With this definition, then, there are two ways that democracy can be limited. I see some people looking at their smartphones. You guys start trolling. I don't want you looking at smartphones. That's not you. If you need to, just you can do it outside, but not in class. Okay. There's two ways that democracy can be limited, if we take that as our core definition of what we mean by democracy. First, the scope of democracy can be restricted. Some kinds of decisions which significantly affect our common fate and collective interests are excluded from public decision making. So you can imagine, this is a made-up world, but you can imagine a world in which you have fully democratic participation of equal citizens, but all that they're allowed to decide are the number and timing of public holidays. Right, so you have a constitution in place which says every rule and form of coordination that involves things other than public holidays will be made by an aristocratic elite without accountability to the people, but we will allow the people in their through their parliaments or whatever to choose the timing and date of public holidays. Well, we would all say that's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. It's implausible that you'd ever get a world like that, because why would anybody bother participating in democracy if all you could decide was the date of public holidays? Well, that would be an extreme restriction of the scope of democracy. That would be saying that there's a vast array of things which massively affect the lives of people, but the people aren't allowed to decide those things. You're not allowed to participate in all this big array of decisions that affect your life, only the timing of public holidays. That would be a really narrow democracy. And I think what we would end up saying is that a government, a political system like that, was less democratic, even if it was deeply democratic around that narrow scope. So the idea of democracy implies something about the scope of the decisions that fall under the heading decisions which affect your common fate. And if that's too narrow, or as that narrows, I think it's appropriate to say a system becomes less democratic. And this is something which constantly comes up. This is a very big deal issue. Should we be able to regulate pharmaceuticals that go into the market? That is, should we require, as a rule that governs the introduction of pharmaceuticals, that they pass a certain set of tests to prove that they're effective and safe? Should we impose that restriction on drug companies? Right? So that's a rule that we could have or not have. In the 19th century, we didn't have any rules like that. What was often called snake oil, you know, the medicine, the pharmaceutical company that would go into a small town and you'd have a salesman get out on the town square and have all these tonics that would cure all your maladies, and they could make any claim they wanted to. There was no regulation whatsoever. They could sell you stuff that not only wouldn't cure your diseases, that were actually harmful to you. Narcotics were put into elixirs and people got addicted. The narcotics made you feel better. They didn't cure your disease, but they made you feel better. And that was perfectly legal, and that's why it was referred to as snake oil. That's the sort of expression for these phony drugs. Well, for good reason, eventually we came to the conclusion that we can't just let the market decide what the rules are going to be, and we can't just let every individual decide how careful they are going to be in the claims they make and in the testing of their drugs. No, we need a set of rules for this. And we have to enforce them, which means we have to have a bureaucratic structure, and they have to have procedures, which is then belittled as red tape, but that's what procedures are. It says you have to go through these steps in order to get a drug approved. But there's constant pressure to get rid of that, to whittle it down, to create what is called fast track for drugs. What does fast track mean? It means you're less confident that they won't harm people, and you're less confident that they'll actually have benefits. That's what fast track means. Now, maybe there are circumstances in which that's a good idea. So I think in a complicated world where there are issues of balancing the speed and confidence and risks you're prepared to take against the possible benefits of relaxing a rule, it may well be that there are circumstances in which exceptions should be made. But for sure, I think most people believe that under the scope of democracy, we've made a system more democratic by allowing such rules than it would be if we prohibited such rules. And that's the idea of the scope of democracy. The scope of democracy doesn't refer to the content of what you actually decide, but the scope of problems and issues in life which are open to be decided through democratic means. And there's large areas of regulation, of social regulation, which just means rules to be sure certain things are done around things like automobile safety, drug safety, food safety, all sorts of things of that sort, which most people just take for granted, but which had to be fought over because in an earlier era, that was outside of the scope of democracy. We are a more democratic society than in the 19th century, in part, because there are more things that affect our lives which are now fair game to be subjected to our collective rulemaking. So that's the scope of democracy. And so one way you can limit democracy or you can erode democracy is to erode the scope, to narrow down what we are allowed to consider in our collective deliberation over rules and decisions. And the second way that democracy can be undermined is by undermining the process of democracy. With whatever the scope is, you can have a big scope or a narrower scope. Within the existing scope of public decisions, some kinds of citizens have much more power than others to affect those decisions. So in a democracy, it's equal citizens who have access to the means to participate. It's the equality of citizens that's crucial for the process of democracy. If you had a democratic system in which only some people could participate, even if the scope was very broad, we would say it was less democratic. So in the history of American society, American democracy, at the beginning, only property owners could vote, only male property owners. You know, at the time of the founding of the American Republic and the wonderful, symbolically salient myth of our founding fathers. Fathers is the right word. They were all men. Decided who should have the vote. Initially, it was limited to property owners. The idea behind that, the justification, was only property owners really had a stake in the society. If you didn't own property, then you wouldn't care enough about the society to be responsible in your casting of votes. That was the justification, but it was really just a justification based on privilege. Well, I think nobody in the United States today hardly would say, yeah, we would be improving and deepening our democratic society if we required people to have a certain level of wealth before they could vote. You know, everyone would see that as a undermining of the process of democracy. Historically, we've become more democratic as we first eliminated the property franchise. Secondly, when we made it possible for women to vote. Third, when we finally, in the 1960s, got rid of racial bars, effective racial exclusions in the franchise. And a bit later, I think, when we lowered the age of voting from 21 to 18. Arguably, the age of voting should be lowered still further to 16. There are places in the world which are actively considering, and some places, I believe, which have a 16-year-old franchise. The idea being that if you lower the franchise to younger people, you will actually get them involved in politics earlier, and they will become more active citizens at a point in their lives where developing those habits and those orientations, you know, you could build into your high school curriculum civic participation and political participation in an environment which could then create more robust participatory orientation on the part of people. I'm not sure if that's right or not, but it's certainly an interesting idea. The United States still has more legal disenfranchisement than most democracies. So if somebody has been convicted of a felony in some states in the United States, even after they're out of prison, and even after they're done with whatever probation, so they're completely free of the criminal justice system, they still can't vote. That is, they cannot restore their full citizenship rights. They lose it forever when you are convicted of a felony, unless you get a specific pardon for that or restoration of your rights from the governor or some other process. That felony exclusion rule was established in the Jim Crow era in the southern states, specifically as a way of reinforcing the disenfranchisement of blacks. There is absolutely no question in the historical record that that was the motivation for those exclusions. And it continues to have a significant effect on the African-American voting population because of the experience of mass incarceration in the last four decades or so. I personally feel that that is a deeply undemocratic principle, that the whole idea of imprisonment is that that's the punishment for whatever crime, that's an attempt to deter crime and then to create consequences in the lives of people for certain kinds of criminal behavior. Once a person has paid their debt to society, as the expression goes, I think they should be restored to full citizenship rights. That should be part of the view of our society, that we don't permanently punish people. We have punishments proportionate to the offense, and that a person doesn't cease to be a person worthy of inclusion in our political community. So we still have some ways to go, but pretty much I think we can say in the United States today, we are very close to a universal franchise for adults 18 years and older. And that's an improvement in the process of democracy. So here's a question for you. What's wrong with the idea of a wealthy group or organization buying votes? I will give you $1,000 if you vote for the candidate I support. Why not have a free market in votes? I mean, if people who defend the market, who believe the market solves all problems, I mean, I'm caricaturing it, you know, I think nobody believes the market solves all problems, but the market is efficient. You certainly would have an improvement of efficiency if you could buy votes. It would be cheaper than spending the amount of money you're spending on political ads to buy votes directly than to try to persuade people through distorted ads to vote for particular people. The people who receive the money would be better off because they must not care very much about their vote, so that's not something very valuable to them, whereas $1,000 is. What's wrong with having a straightforward way for rich people, for wealth holders, for large corporations to influence elections? Have it be transparent. You buy the votes rather than just influence the votes. turn to the, we'll do one of our short, 2 minutes by the clock, I'll look at it, discussions. Turn to somebody next to you and come up with an argument for and against buying votes directly. Why is, what's creepy about that idea? Or not? Why maybe some of you think this would be a more honest way of running our elections. Okay, got 2 minutes. Turn to the person next to you. Should we sell votes? Okay, I hear the level of buzz declining, so we must have passed the peak of new ideas. So what do you think? Why do you think it's a good or bad idea to buy votes? You're all talking, so some of you have, yeah.
Well, the shift will eventually be votes aren't it, it's money. Because votes aren't worth money, so then it's basically boils down to money.
So the objection is that it means that it's money that's determining the outcome of elections rather than votes. $1, one vote, rather than one person, one vote, so to speak. Well, some people argue that that's what it is anyway. So wouldn't this just be more transparent? Wouldn't this just be more honest? Yeah. Right. So if we assume that rich people, wealthy corporations, will buy votes only for those politicians or parties which support their interests, then in effect, wealthy people would be determining the decisions on the basis of their interests, and it would no longer be government for the people, it would be government for the corporation. Other thoughts on this. So here's the point of this silly question. I mean, it's fundamentally a silly question in the sense that nobody is actually proposing that we have a free market in votes. But if we have a political system which kind of looks like that, even though it takes a different mechanism. So the mechanism, this is a particularly ugly mechanism, right? It's a particularly ugly way of ensuring that it's government for the corporate world rather than government for the people, is to actually buy the votes. But if we have a system that's organized in such a way to accomplish something close to that anyway, should we be critical of it? Or so long as you don't directly buy votes and it's still people making their own minds up and deciding what to do, even if they're doing so in a system that's heavily rigged towards powerful interests determining the character of the choices you face and the kind of information you get, should we then think, well, that's okay because it's, after all, not directly buying votes? Well, these are themes we're going to explore in the course of this section of the course. The ways in which even if you have a formal equality of citizens, you can end up with tremendous inequalities in the actual capacity of people to translate their individual will as part of the collective will that gets organized through elections. So here are two important facts, which I think are not really controversial. Two important facts about American democracy. Some things which I'll be saying in the course of this part of the course, just like things I've been saying earlier, are very controversial. I don't think this is controversial. This is just a kind of observation about the way things work that should be viewed as pretty valid, regardless of your political perspective. Private power directly makes publicly important decisions. Many decisions that are of momentous importance to society as a whole and have deep public ramifications are made as private decisions by corporations and wealthy individuals. Now, to say this does not answer the question, is this a good or bad thing? One might argue, for example, that this is the only way you can organize decision-making over, for example, investments, because every other way will be worse. So even if it's true that private individuals and corporations are making decisions that massively affect the lives of others, well, there's no alternative. And that is a really good argument. I mean, I think that's the kind of argument you need to make to defend the concentrations of power in which private individuals acting on their own interests can make decisions that have huge effects on other people's lives without those other people having any capacity to participate in the decision. You can say, yes, I believe in democracy in general, but on this set of issues, if we were to subject them to democratic control, everybody would be worse off. It would be even worse. There'd be even more harms to people. That's a pragmatic argument. Remember, we made this distinction between arguments that are based on moral principle and arguments that are just based on the pragmatic consequences of different situations. So if that were true, that there is no alternative that would take into account the effects on other people while still allowing reasonable forms of market activity, you know, basically if there's no alternative, if there was no alternative, then this would just be a tragic and unfortunate feature of a society. Well, we've looked at this in the first part of the course when I discussed the problem of negative externalities and the effects of markets. And we will discuss it more in this section when we look at the functioning of government and how it works. But the fact itself that private power directly makes publicly important decisions, I think, is an uncontroversial point. Corporations make decisions that massively affect the lives of people. And they make it on the basis of their own profit-seeking self-interest. And that's legally not just allowed, it's in fact, in a very strange way, it's required. The charters under which corporations are organized and the mandates to the board of directors of most corporations, there are some special exceptions, corporations which have a different mandate, their responsibility is, it's called fiduciary responsibility, it's to maximize the interests of the corporation. They are not supposed to take into account the consequences of their actions for others. Okay, that's the first fact. The second fact is that the private control over resources represented by the first fact, so the first fact is that there's these huge private concentrations of power that make decisions that affect everybody's life. So the second fact is that the private control of resources in that first fact pervasively impinges on democratic decision-making over everything else. So it's not just that corporations can decide where they're going to invest, what technologies to use, where to locate their factories, when to close a factory, when to fire workers. It's not just that corporations exercise that kind of power directly, which has effects on the public, but the concentration of power which they have by virtue of those resources also enables them to affect decisions about how many daycare centers should we have, What kind of parental leave policy should we have to affect issues of gender? What kinds of anti-poverty programs should we have? That is, things which they don't directly decide. It's not that a corporation, when it makes its investments, directly decides on national daycare policies or on national anti-poverty programs. No, that's not, that is something which they're not directly deciding. But their concentrations of resources enables them to pervasively affect decision-making, democratic decision-making, around all of those other things. And thus undermine the requirement of a democracy that it represent the collective will of ordinary citizens, of equal citizens who are equal within the political system. To understand how this really works, to understand how these facts actually play themselves out in our society, I need to introduce then some more abstract ideas. By the way, this is really a lecture that spans both today and next Tuesday. It's two parts to the same lecture. So I'll begin the discussion of these issues today. And we will then just continue. We'll just stop wherever we are, and we'll just continue this on Tuesday. So the idea of how democracy actually works. We need some concepts. The concepts that I'm going to build this argument around involve two different kinds of constraints. Constraints on the democraticness of a democracy. The first constraint is called the demand constraint. And the second constraint is the resource constraint. The demand constraint is defined as follows. The demand constraint refers to restrictions on what people are prepared to demand from the government. And the resource constraint refers to the different capacities different people have to pursue their political demands. We'll discuss each of these in turn. The demand constraint says there are constraints on what people can demand from the government. You can't demand everything that you might want. There's just only certain things that you are actually able to demand, to pose as demands that you'd like to see the government do something about. And the second constraint, the resource constraint, says even among the demands that are makeable, people have different resources available to actually accomplish their demands. This is therefore about what people want and what kind of power they have to get what they want. The demand constraint constrains what people want, what they feel they can ask of the government, and the resource constraint affects the power they have to accomplish what they want. So you can think of when we're looking at how democracy works and what inhibits democracy, what reduces the democraticness of democracy, we can group the problem under these two broad headings, the demand constraint and the resource constraint. So first, let's look at the demand constraint. Here's the question for which it's the answer. How do we explain the kinds of demands that get raised in the political system? Why is it that most of the time do most people limit their demands to things which are compatible with the economic interests of business corporations? Why are the demands that people make subjected to the requirement that they be compatible with business interests? So here's the basic argument. In capitalism, profits provide the motive for investment by competing private firms. And investment is the necessary condition for realizing everyone's economic interests. Right, so that's a simple description of the character of our economy. If we're going to have jobs in a market economy organized by private corporations and businesses, the jobs will be created by private investment. Jobs are good for everybody. We need jobs. Everyone, you know, in the society benefits from having employment. Since profits provide the motive for investment, and investment is the necessary condition for realizing everyone's economic interests, this means that the welfare of everyone depends upon the welfare of capitalists. Everybody's welfare depends upon capitalists doing well. The rules of the game of a capitalist democracy ensure that, in general, only those political demands get recognized that are compatible with capitalist interests and a good business climate. This has two important implications. First, the interests of business appear to be the general interest rather than special interests, while the interests of other groups are special interests. Now, that's a really important thing to keep in mind. You hear about special interests all the time in political debate and how the government shouldn't cater to special interests. But a good business climate, a good investment climate, is experienced by the system and by people in the system as not a special interest. That's in everybody's interest to have a good business climate. It's in everybody's interest to have a good business climate. Not just a special interest. Whereas if you say, start talking about the interests of the poor, how can we expand programs for the poor? Or the interests of workers, for example, how do we strengthen their capacity to form unions? Those are seen as special interests, not general interests. This is a kind of key idea. There's a famous slogan from the 1950s from the president of General Motors: what's good for General Motors is good for America. Well, that rings true. You know, that seems right, doesn't it? I mean, certainly it's bad for the society, for big corporations to go bankrupt, for big corporations to make healthy profits and invest and create jobs. That's good for everyone. The interests of business, therefore, appears to be in the general interest, whereas the interests of everyone else seems to be particular interests or special interests. That's the first implication. And the second implication is there's a strong tendency for people to limit their demands to those that are consistent with a good business climate. Before proposing any policy, you have to ask, how does this affect business? And you see that constantly in political discussions. And the main objection to various kinds of regulations is what? It'll be bad for business. And therefore, it will cost jobs. That's a nice, that's a kind of interesting bit of political rhetoric. If you regulate the environment, if you put these emissions controls on automobiles and regulate CO2 emissions from plants, what are the consequences? It's bad for business, and therefore it will lose jobs. So in the current political climate, the argument is not that we should just do things that are good for business. It's that we should do things that are good for business, reduce these regulations, because it will create jobs. That's invoking the general interest that's tied to the interests of business. And that's a natural equation. And it's not a phony equation. I mean, it may be phony in particular cases, of course. But that connection is a real connection. That's a hardwired connection in the kind of economy we are in. And that's what's generating these constraints on the sorts of demands that people make. So you, before you propose any policy, you have to ask the question, how does this affect business? Politicians don't have to ask the question, how does this affect the poor? How does this affect children? Now, from an ethical or moral standpoint, we could say of every policy, does it pass the it's good for children test? Right? That would be a reasonable thing in a humane society to say. Every policy has to go through the Office of Child Welfare Department, and they score every policy on the basis of whether it's going to be good or bad for children. There are places in the world that have introduced gender evaluation departments. That is, any piece of legislation has to, you have to ask the question, how does this affect women? You have to get a score on the gender issue. And increasingly, there are calls to have an environmental score. You know, every policy, you should ask the question, is it neutral? Does it make the environment worse, or does it help the environment? Many policies will be irrelevant, so many policies will just have a neutral score. But you would want an environmental test. And why? Because what's good for the environment is good for everybody. Well, we have a business test, in effect. When politicians argue about policies, they argue, if it's bad for business, it's a bad policy. But they don't, in general, argue if it's bad for the poor, if it's bad for children, if it's bad for the environment, therefore it's a bad policy. Well, that's the nature of this demand constraint. That means before, if you're a politician or a political party, and you're trying to formulate policies that will benefit a particular constituency, you have to ask yourself the question, will it pass the good for business test? And if it doesn't, it'll be much harder to even raise the policy option within the political arena. This was one of the huge constraints imposed on the efforts to reform the American healthcare system, which we discussed in the first part of the course. The whole issue of how we should organize the payment for medical services in the United States. Because of the power of insurance companies, one of the criteria for a possible policy was, will it harm the insurance industry? Not will it make for cheaper, more equitable healthcare system, but what will be its implications for the insurance industry? The insurance industry employs hundreds of thousands of people. It has tremendous power, but also, even apart from its lobbying power, it has tremendous importance within the economy. And a policy which would damage the insurance industry would be harmful for the economy as a whole. And that was a very serious consideration. And it's the reason we ended up with a healthcare reform which places private insurance at the center, as opposed to a healthcare reform which would place the direct public provision of insurance at the center. Okay, that's the resource, the demand constraint. The way in which the fundamental organization of our economic institutions impose constraints on the scope of democracy. Now, the resource constraint. These are constraints that come from the resources people have available to deploy within politics. And here's the basic idea. The demand constraint imposes limits on what people are likely to demand, but it doesn't dictate unique outcomes. The resource constraint helps explain what happens within those limits. Different groups have access to different kinds of resources which they can deploy in political conflicts to influence political outcomes. Individuals and corporations with high income and wealth are able to use those resources effectively to influence political processes. In an ideal democracy, you would have some kind of barrier, some mechanism which would block the ability of people to translate their personal power from their own personal resources, their wealth, that would block their ability to translate personal power into political power. Right? So if you really want government of the people and by the people, you have to somehow obstruct the translation of private power into public power, because that translation undermines the equality of citizens in their ability to participate and influence decisions. The resource constraint on democracy says, well, that just doesn't occur. Individuals and corporations with high income and wealth are able to use those resources effectively to influence political processes and outcomes. Well, here's some simple examples. The interesting problems come with the less simple examples, the more complex examples, but let's begin with just some simple examples. Well, here's the simplest of all examples, bribes, corruption, side deals. You know, direct payments to politicians to support particular rules, particular legislation, direct corruption. In some parts of the world, that is the key way in which private power is turned into public policy. It's through directly buying off politicians. The United States actually is a relatively uncorrupt political system. I mean, we get all these scandals. Politicians go to jail periodically for taking bribes. But I don't think the main indictment of the way in which private wealth is turned into public policy, the main indictment in the US is that it's done through direct bribery. That does happen. It happens notoriously in local, municipal, city politics. You can see in city politics, the stakes can be pretty high for real estate developers. The classic story in cities is that there are developers who have particular interests in having certain kinds of development, but they can't do the development unless there is municipal support. There needs to be zoning rules that are changed. There needs to be new highways and sewers that are built. There's all sorts of things that cities have to do to allow certain kinds of development to occur. And the temptation to not just support politically those politicians who are favorable to development, but to pay them under the table, to get them to actually be in your pocket, as it were, those temptations are big. And in American history, there are countless examples of that kind of local corruption. Corruption is particularly intense, I think, at that local level. At the national level, it does happen. There are senators and congressmen who have gone to jail. There was a notorious case, I forget the name of the Louisiana politician, but who had several hundred thousand dollars stashed in a freezer in his house that he had received as direct bribes to support particular interests. So that does happen. But I think it would be a mistake to see that as the heart of the matter. That's not the main way in which private resources get translated into public policy. A second way is the prospects for high-paying jobs after leaving office. Now, that doesn't have to take the form of a direct quid pro quo. You know, you're working in the Department of State or in the Treasury Department. You're developing all sorts of policies. You're implementing rules. You're involved in monitoring compliance to various kinds of rules. All sorts of things you do as a government employee. Or as a politician, you're on various legislative committees and you support certain bills and not others. It's not that you necessarily have a promise in advance. If you support our legislation, we'll give you a high-paying job when you leave government service. Nevertheless, if you support policies that are hostile to powerful interests, your probabilities of getting a job, a high-paying job in those industries, is lower. And therefore, it's, I think, the case that one way in which the resource constraint operates, perhaps more clearly for government employees who are involved in regulatory sectors of the state, than it is for elected politicians, but it can work for them as well, is that if they are thinking that they want a career outside of government after they leave government service, they will have an eye to where the money is, where the good-paying jobs are. Some people will. And that influences their behavior when they're in government roles. That's another example of the way in which the resource constraint operates. Campaign contributions. Well, that's a big one. We'll be discussing that when we look at elections and how elections work. Campaign contributions need not take the simplest you know, pay to play kind of mechanism. I'll give you $100,000 for your campaign if you support my legislation. It doesn't have to be that crude of a direct quid pro quo. Sometimes it is. But more often, a politician signals that they are going to be supportive of particular kinds of legislation, and then contributors say, aha, let's support that politician. And since some contributors have much more resources to lend, to give than others, that acts as a way that resources, private resources, get translated into public power. And finally, control over the mass media. That's also an important issue. The mass media is primarily owned by powerful corporations. Public broadcasting is an exception, although its insulation from private power has declined over time as it becomes more reliant on corporate donations for its own functioning. But it's still not directly owned and controlled by corporations in the ways that, you know, Fox News and CNN and other major mass media outlets are. And the control over mass media by powerful and wealthy corporations affects the way in which they cover the politics, and that in turn affects the kinds of policies and political orientations that are given credibility or that lack credibility. And that's another pretty straightforward way that politics is influenced by private resources. We'll be discussing that as well in a specific section on the media. And on Tuesday, we will look at two complex examples, how the free riding problem affects wealthy and disadvantaged groups differently, and then a very interesting idea, which is called rational ignorance. See you then.